Vice President Joe Biden is preparing maybe for the biggest speech of his life tonight as he formally accepts the Democratic Party's nomination for president during their national convention. This is after Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren addressed the convention last night, and California Senator Kamala Harris marked her historic ascension as the first Black woman and Asian American on a major party presidential ticket. So here to discuss what it all means for us in New England is Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Congresswoman Pressley, welcome back to Radio Boston. Congresswoman?
I'm here. Good to be with you.
Glad to have you. Thanks. You know, we have not spoken since Senator Harris was announced as Joe Biden's running mate. You are no stranger to firsts as an elected official, and I'm wondering how you're reflecting on this moment.
Sure. Well, neither is Senator Harris. You know, her personal life and certainly her entire public life have been a symbolic, representative, trailblazing first. And so this is just one more step in that regard. Last night I was watching her accept the nomination, watching her speech with my husband and our daughter, and he was braiding her hair, and it was an incredible moment. I think her speech really effectively gave tribute to the generations of women who came before her, whose dreams and ambitions she embodied. And honestly, I think her nomination is really long overdue recognition of the vital role that Black women have played, not only in the Democratic Party, but especially the most reliably voting constituency. Black women have been the table shakers, the truth tellers, the preservers of our democracy, and at the forefront of every social movement, including as we talk about the centennial for the ratification of the 19th Amendment, allies in that fight, even though Black women did not even have the right to vote until 55 years later after that. And so this really honors that. And Senator Harris and I have both spoken very often about the role our mothers have played in our lives, and so I knew that she would bring Shamla into the room, and she honored her mother with her conviction and the values that she placed center stage, the grace, all the things that her mother poured into her. And I think she demonstrated her allegiance to the highest ideals of this country and her commitment to do the work in pursuit of racial, economic, health care, just in the name of justice, period. The fact that she said we still have work to do for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. This is for having a Black woman that on the ticket, you know, at this level, who's been in proximity to these issues and can say unapologetically that Black lives matter. So it was
an historic day. Let's pick up on that for a moment, Congresswoman. Senator Harris, in her speech last night, spoke about the racial disparity and how people are affected by the coronavirus. Here she is.
Black, Latino, and Indigenous people are suffering and dying disproportionately. And this is not a coincidence. It is the effect of structural racism, of inequities in education and technology, healthcare and housing, job security and transportation. This virus, it has no eyes, and yet it knows exactly how we see each other.
We know these disparities exist here in Boston, and we know that the party ratified its platform earlier this week, even amid controversy that didn't move close enough to Medicare for All. And I want to ask you, are you satisfied that the national platform, as it now stands, represents the needs not only of the people in your district, but of the people of Massachusetts as a whole?
Well, there were many things that were reflected in the platform, that I think are representative of many of the progressive policies and changes that I've certainly been organizing for and fighting for. But on Medicare for All, I do believe it fell short, especially in the midst of a pandemic. But I want to be very clear in saying this, that the platform and the convention and not even Election Day, that is not a capstone or an ending, a bookend to our work. In many ways, it's just beginning. You know, the election of Vice President Biden and Senator Harris will really be more of a door than a destination. After that, it's going to be up to us to continue to challenge them, to partner with them, to organize, to mobilize, for this more equitable and just world. And as I've said oftentimes, in quoting Reverend Barber, we are in the midst of a national reckoning, and it does demand of us a third reconstruction. And that's the part that I'm committed to, is this rebuilding, so that when we are beyond this pandemic, that we are not returning to a normal that was insufficient, unjust, and inadequate to begin with.
You mentioned challenging and partnering with a future Biden-Harris administration, which is something that we saw between Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, was the challenging and then the partnering. Last night, Senator Warren gave a convention speech where she used her reputation as the plans candidate to endorse Biden's policy. I want to play a bit of that for you.
Now, I love a good plan. And Joe Biden has some really good plans. Plans to bring back union jobs in manufacturing and create new union jobs in clean energy. Plans to increase Social Security benefits, cancel billions in student loan debt. These plans reflect a central truth. Our economic system has been rigged to give bailouts to billionaires and kick dirt in the face of everyone else.
So during the primary, Joe Biden got a lot of criticism, including from Elizabeth Warren, about not being progressive enough. And I believe it's part of the reason you endorsed Elizabeth Warren over the rest of the field. Has she now made her stamp on this ticket and its platform?
I think Elizabeth Warren has made her stamp on our country, on our democracy. And her remarks last night are exactly why I was so proud to endorsed her, to serve as one of her three national co-chairs, and why I'm proud that she's our senator. She showed the empathy, the compassion, and the strength that defined her as a candidate for president. And, you know, she spoke directly to me. I knew she was going to center policy. That's why I endorsed her for president. Policy is my love language, and she speaks to that. You know, the fact that she was centering this issue of child care and how critical it is to our infrastructure, period. But especially as we seek to recover from these conflated public health and economic crises as a result of this pandemic. She really does deeply understand the importance of intentional, inclusive policymaking to address the hurt and harm facing our communities. And so I think she effectively drove home the importance of doing the work to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, as well as the equal importance of remaining engaged after November 3rd. To stay in the fight, to continue to organize, to continue to advocate. And she got in that big structural change, you know. So as I said earlier, the work is on us. Their election is not the destination. It's simply a door.
There has been a lot of criticism of the DNC from the left of not giving enough space to young progressive voices like you, like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I want to ask yourself, do you see yourself, your constituents, your priorities represented in this convention?
Of course, I just want to acknowledge the very powerful and unifying message that Representative Ocasio-Cortez offered. So she made good of her 1 minute and delivered a unifying message that speaks to the strength of our movement. And our movement is not one that could fit on or be contained on a stage for a week. The movement is what is happening in communities. It's what's happening on these streets with the sustained moment of intolerance for injustice at all levels. So I'm encouraged by the strength of our movement. I do believe that with Senator Harris on this ticket, that we are going to see residual benefits when it comes to our regaining control of the Senate and growing our numbers and strengthening our majority in the House.
And that's Congresswoman.
So, you know, people, I just want to just, you know, people not being a part of a convention program in no way erases or minimizes the contributions of the work that that we've done and will continue to do, because ultimately that's how change is ushered in. It's through these movements.
Thank you, Congresswoman. That's Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Be well.
You too. In this week of so much politics, local, national, let's now turn to someone connected to all of it, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's a pleasure to have you. Governor, you ran for president this cycle in part because you said you felt the field wasn't gaining enough momentum in a critical election year. How are you feeling about the final ticket today?
Great, Tiziana. Terrific, for two reasons. One, I think that the very movement and the pressure that your previous guest, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, was talking about has had an impact on the platform and on the thinking of Joe Biden. I know that because I've spoken with him, and I think you've seen that in the way some of his policy agenda has become more ambitious than it was when he stepped out. And secondly, I think adding Kamala Harris to the ticket was masterful. She is a fierce advocate and a tireless and effective campaigner. And I think she too will push him. And I think that what we're seeing in the vice president is one of two really, really great personal qualities that I think make him the right candidate for the moment. One that we hear a lot about is his empathy, which is real and deep. But the second is that he listens. And we're at a time where there are a lot of strong opinions about how to address some big and chronic challenges facing our country. And the fact that his mind and his ears are open, I think, creates a real opportunity for all of us.
So let's stay on Vice President Biden for a minute. I was eager to talk to you about the convention because I want to think about what this race, this election season, means for us here in the Commonwealth specifically. Mm-hmm. And one of our colleagues here, Alex Ashlock, reminded us of when Joe Biden, when he was vice president, came to Boston 6 years ago for the mm-hmm. one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. And we yes. pulled a cut of the speech. I'd like to play it for you. He's at the Heinz Convention Center. It's April 15, 2014, and he's paying tribute to the victims, the injured, and people who responded to the scene. Here he is.
That's what Bostonians do. That's what Bostonians did. That's what the whole world saw. That's what America does. And next Monday, on Patriots Day, when I'm told up to 36,000 people line up to start the marathon, you will send a resounding message around the world, not just to the rest of the world, but to the terrorists, that we will never yield. We will never cower. America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
So much there, especially in a year where now we're actually not running the Boston Marathon this year. Yes. What's your reaction to hearing that again? And will we hear that Joe Biden tonight?
Well, I haven't previewed the speech, and I have to imagine that for all of the speakers, the idea of speaking direct to camera rather than in a hall where you're getting the feedback from the crowd has had some impact. But I will say, as a viewer, what I have loved about the convention, in addition to the fact that every possible type and kind of American has been represented, and it's been a beautiful, beautiful portrait of our country, has been that we have been able to focus really on the words and the ideas, and they've been quite compelling. And I think we'll see that from Joe Biden. He understands the gravity of the moment, not just because it is always a big deal to be formally accepting the nomination of a party and to have the prospect of becoming president, but because he is a servant leader, he understands that, and he understands that's what we particularly need right now. And that the healing is not going to be just kind of glossing over and getting back to what we used to do, which is a conversation he and I have had very pointedly. Much as I love Barack Obama, Barack Obama would tell you that going back to his time as president is not exactly what the country needs right now.
Of all the things that you talked to Joe Biden about, of all the things that you wanted to affect in your candidacy, what is most important that you see the Biden-Harris ticket carry forward?
Well, you know, we can talk about policy. I think he and I are probably quite aligned on how to take the ACA to the next level and how important it is to have a public option. I wouldn't be surprised if we find that that public option is Medicare for a host of reasons, but I don't want to forecast that. I'm purely speculating. I think that I'm hoping that the very first policy initiative that the new administration pushes, God willing, we have a new administration, is the reform of the democracy itself. The amount of money, the hyper partisan gerrymandering, the vote suppression, the purging, the various ways compounded now during this pandemic, that we have made it harder for people to participate and to get the government that they deserve. And I think doing that first, up to and including minimizing the impact and influence of lobbyists, makes a way for a fair competition of ideas across the rest of the policy platform.
And what could success in that mean for and in Massachusetts?
Well, look, you know, I think that, and I say this, you know, with a mixture of warmth and criticism, we have a pretty tight, inward-looking, hard-to-penetrate political establishment. The dynamic here is less Democrat-Republican than it is insider-outsider. And I think that there are more and more newcomers stepping up and competing. And I think that is a great thing, whether they win or lose, because I think folks need to feel that they aren't entitled to the jobs they hold in elective office, that they win, they earn the opportunity to serve if they serve. And that means not just listening to the powerful, it's listening to the meek as well, and finding ways to include all voices and all perspectives.
I want to continue to bring our focus here into the Commonwealth. In a couple minutes ago, we talked about Joe Biden's speech here after the Marathon bombing. You were governor for that crisis. We're in another very painful and difficult kind of crisis now. How do you feel about the state of our Commonwealth right now?
Well, I think that Governor Baker has a really, really tough job, as I do governors across the country, because, you know, being effectively told by the White House, you're on your own, you figure it out and call us if you need something, but we won't promise you that we'll respond to your call, is just an impossible way to deal with something which does not respect state lines. I think that that the governor and his team have been doing a really, really great job. I have said that I felt they were slow to start, but I think they've gotten their pace now, and they're modeling the importance of dealing with science and fact, and not taking undue risk. And I think they have earned the confidence and the trust of the electorate with respect to dealing with the pandemic. But it is so hard to deal with something like this within a state. You know, the Marathon bombing, we suspected and worked around and toward understanding whether there were connections beyond Massachusetts, certainly beyond Boston. And we had the resources to do that. But at the end of the day, we were dealing with an incident that was confined to Boston and affected people in the greater Boston area. We weren't having to deal with the incident itself crossing state lines, and that's materially different from what the governor and his team are having to deal with right now. So, you know, we are all wishing them well. It's just a terrible and difficult decision to try to think about, for example, what to do about kids going back to school. The kids want it, the parents want it, but everybody wants it to be safe. And it's just really hard to see quite how you do that. And as I say, especially hard to do it when we're not getting consistent guidance at the federal level.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. You know, we've been following that in depth here on Radio Boston, and it's been so painful for all the parties involved. We've talked to parents, teachers, superintendents, who all, I think, have great frustration, not only that there are only what seem to be bad options, but that centralized information and centralized standards could have made more difference. Does the state, you've talked about the federal need for that. Does the state have a role in that? And how do you strike the balance between mandates and freedom of choice and movement for districts in such a tough situation?
Well, you know, and part of it that makes it tough, I shouldn't laugh, but it's just from our experiences, grandparents of a seven-year-old, you know, homeschooling is no joke. It is hard. You know, if there are silver linings to some of this, I hope more folks are respecting and honoring what teachers do day in and day out. It's magical. And it's enabling, of course, especially for working parents. I think, you know, this notion of centralized mandates versus individual freedom, it's a luxury to be able to talk about this sort of thing in the abstract. There is a responsibility that makes freedom possible. Freedom to me is not just being able to do whatever you want to whomever you want because you feel like it. It is understanding the responsibility you have as a member of a free community. And if we are to have an enduring community, then we're going to have to think about our stake and our impact on each other. And I think that is what makes the need for having at least a common understanding of the challenge and common guidelines useful. Now, how people adapt those guidelines to their individual situations, the individual schools and classrooms and families, there's a lot of room for that, a lot of room for creativity. But having the guidelines uniform seems to me a service that the government owes us right now.
Well, the clock in the background reminds me of our clock, too. I'd love to keep
talking
to you.
I'm sorry about
that. That's all right. It was a treat to talk to you. That's former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. I sure appreciate your time today.
Thank you for yours, Tiziana. Be well.